Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. The sandy coastal area of Al-Mawasi in southern Gaza has been designated as a humanitarian zone for displaced Palestinians since shortly after the conflict began last year. Last night, the Israeli military targeted what they said was a Hamas command centre in the area with an airstrike. Eyewitnesses report seeing massive explosions, and now there's a huge crater about the size of a small football pitch and several metres deep. The Hamas-run health authority says at least 40 people have been killed and another 60 or so injured. The Israeli authorities dispute those numbers, but throughout today, local rescue teams have been digging in the sand, trying to find people they say are still buried, who disappeared with the explosions. This man works for civil defence and was in Al-Mawasi at the time of the strikes.
About an hour ago, we heard the sounds of very violent bombing without prior warning. Due to the intensity of the airstrikes, we ran away in search of safe places to take shelter in. The bombing was so violent that the missile made a hole 15 metres deep in the ground. The bodies of the martyrs are scattered everywhere, and we're having to pull people out with our bare hands.
Well, earlier I got through to Suhas Shahat, who's a pharmacist at the nearby Nasser Hospital where many of the wounded were taken. It is a rather chaotic scene, so the sound quality isn't great, but she told me she saw the explosion overnight.
As I was close to the place, I see the bomb, more than five bombs. It travel over me to the target place. The sound is very loud. All the area become lighted because of the bombing fire. I was asleep and my children, we all get very terrified because of the sound. It is very, very loud and high. Today at morning, I was go to the hospital as I work in the Nasser Hospital. So I met some of medical staff who deal with the last night event. Some of them tell me it over 65 was injury. Some of injury and some of dead body, they get to the hospital on the animal because it is very busy on the ambulance.
So you're saying the ambulances couldn't get through to the area and people were coming in on what, donkeys or?
Yeah, because the amount of the injury and the kills, they try to with ambulance and with cars and on the animals.
So the Israeli government is saying that they were targeting senior Hamas terrorists that were there, but this was a humanitarian area designated.
The target area yesterday was classified as safe area. At Al-Mawasi, most of Canyonist people and Rafah displaced and live in this safe area. And this is very condensed. You know, it is a small area with many, many, many people and a lot of tents close to each other. All of the victims, civilian people, children, mother, older people.
Suha, you mentioned your own children seeing the blast, seeing the light in the sky and the sound of the air strikes last night being very loud and frightening. I mean, we're nearly a year into this conflict now. Is it possible to describe the sort of fear that you and the children, ordinary people, are living under?
Let me tell you, I and my family consider us as the number on the waiting list of this body. No one lives in Gaza. We wait our rule or our number on the waiting list. I am travel every day from my displacement place to the hospital. The road not safe, the hospital not safe, the place itself not safe, my children not safe. They can't target anyone on the road, in the hospital, on the mosque, on the beach. No one safe, no one safe from the target of occupation.
Suha there, pharmacist at the local hospital. Well, we have asked the Israeli Defence Forces for an interview on the details of this strike. They weren't available. They sent us a statement, part of which we've voiced up. It names the Hamas fighters the Israelis say were hit, and it also said,
"These terrorists were directly involved in the execution of the October 7th massacre and have been recently operating to carry out terror activities against the IDF and the State of Israel."
The statement said that precision weapons had been used.
"Despite the extensive measures taken by the IDF to enable the Gazan population to move away from combat zones, including by designating a humanitarian area, the Hamas terrorist organization continues to embed its operatives and military infrastructure in the humanitarian area and systematically use Gazan civilians as a human shield for its terrorist activities."
Part of a statement we got today from the Israeli Defence Forces. Well, we're joined now live from Jerusalem by the BBC's Mike Thompson. Mike, briefly, any more details on what happened and how many still may be missing?
Well, it's unclear still about the number missing, but it's thought the number of confirmed dead has now reached 19, and there have been 26 people taken to a nearby field hospital, some of them with quite severe injuries. As you may know, Hamas has claimed or did claim earlier on there were as many as 40 people dead, but that has not been confirmed so far.
Yes, it's difficult to get precise details as we don't have reporters there. But Mike, we've been trying to get details on from the Israelis as to what ordnance they used in this, because that crater does seem rather large and would indicate a pretty big blast wave, I guess. And people there, no buildings, people are living in tents.
That's right, Rebecca. Yes, I mean, the Israelis have talked about using precision munitions, which would suggest that they've been capable of targeting a very small area without affecting lots of civilians around it. But you can see from this that that hasn't happened. Although in the past, there have been some occasions where they have targeted, perhaps by drones, rather than what looks like, precise or not, extraordinarily powerful weapons. I mean, we heard the description there, the very powerful one you played just now from the woman, the pharmacist, about these massive great craters. Now, that's no small weapon, is it?
Mike, briefly, what has Hamas had to say about this today?
Well, Hamas, as I said earlier, has said that a number of people killed is far greater than was claimed, and they've constantly justified their own actions in Gaza of trying to fight against what they call Israeli oppression and occupation. But yes, they've called it a criminal act. Okay. and are outraged.
The BBC's Mike Thompson live in Jerusalem there. Thank you very much. The next televised US presidential debate is on tonight. The last one was a moment of history, basically forcing an end to Joe Biden's campaign. So this time the lineup has changed. Donald Trump now takes on Kamala Harris. The debate is taking place in the city of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, one of those swing states to which both candidates have been making repeated visits. Our correspondent Tom Bateman has been meeting voters in western Pennsylvania.
Coal train to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, once stopped here and helped fuel the growth of a superpower. From the vast steel mills here, they built modern America. But now most of the factories are rusting hulks that litter the riverside. And for many folks here, they still survive, but among the last of the left behind.
Well, I know that's 11-inch. I worked in there. That was, at the time, the most modern mill they had.
You were building America. You were building a whole country.
Kept, it just kept rolling off there.
Yeah, that steel would come off of there about 80 miles per hour. It would roll into corals like that.
It was a fast mill, fastest mill in the area.
Jack and Wayne, men of steel. They worked here for years, and then the layoffs came.
It's a shame that it went this way here. I mean, Johnstown, when things were going good, when I was working, there was 12,000 people worked here. Cleveland Steel was 12 miles long. Imagine 12 miles long from down in the end there.
Provided all the work.
Yeah, yeah. You thought you was going to be there till you retired, you know.
What do you think the answer to all this is now? Because you've got both Harris and Trump saying they want to reindustrialize. They want to bring back steel jobs. You know, they want to reinvest in the Rust Belt. Do you believe them?
I would believe Donald Trump. I don't believe Harris. She's been there 3.5 years and has done nothing. Now all of a sudden she's going to do something.
So I can tell which way you're going to vote.
Right, here's the hat, buddy.
Bit of a clue.
Yeah. I'm 100%. If it's an honest election, he'll win.
But I'm interested in what you say, because he had 4 years. He had 4 years he could have brought back.
We were energy independent when he was in there.
But we're still looking at this landscape where jobs have gone for years.
This was this way.
But nothing changed in his presidency then, so I'm just interested in why.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as this here, yeah.
But there's a lot of presidents around him and before him that nothing's changed. I mean, this didn't happen overnight.
I'm walking along a disused railway line that runs alongside the old steel mills here. The track timbers are rotted now, and the rail itself, probably forged in this very plant here, is rusting. Donald Trump won this county by a landslide against Joe Biden in 2020. And again, he has rural Pennsylvania under his belt. For Kamala Harris to win, she has to hold on to the big cities and make ground, crucially, in the suburbs. And that is where the battle for Pennsylvania, this critical swing state, is now being fought.
Today we're doing postcards to Democrats who don't usually vote.
Paula Shrively has been organising in Somerset County for years. Now she runs the local Democrats here, of a generation that's seen her state and her country reshaped. Pennsylvania hadn't backed a Republican for nearly three decades when it swung to Trump in 2016. Now she knows how close it is again.
If we could do 2% this year, we'd win. We will never win here when it's 79%, 20% or whatever. We're never going to win here. But what we can do is help win statewide.
Can I leave you just a little thing with the PA Dems?
Street by street, door to door, they're out. And Pennsylvania is being fought to the last zero of every zip code. Back at the Riverside with the former steel worker Wayne, he says he'll be watching tonight's debate too. And then an answer that seems to resonate in this part of rural Pennsylvania. Can he be persuaded by the other side?
The Democrats at one time was for the working man. It's not that way anymore.
Why is that?
This socialist stuff. I mean, look at California. It's too much leniency. New York. I mean, why would anybody want to live in New York?
Good question, I guess. That report from Western Pennsylvania by our correspondent there, Tom Bateman, ahead of that TV debate later today. Still to come, we'll be speaking to C-3PO, also known as Anthony Daniels, on the death of fellow Star Wars actor James Earl Jones, who was 93. So what message would C-3PO have for Darth Vader?
C-3PO, I was built by Anakin Skywalker, and Anakin became Darth Vader. I think I'll miss you, and so will a lot of people.
A treat for Star Wars fans coming up. Our headlines this hour. The EU's competition chief has hailed two separate multi-billion dollar legal rulings against Apple and Google as victories for European citizens. More on that to come. And the UN has condemned a lethal Israeli strike on a humanitarian zone in Gaza and repeated calls for an immediate ceasefire. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, we were just hearing from Pennsylvania a few moments ago, but one of the most important issues nationally in the US election is, and one that's actually being on the ballot in many states in November, is the question of access to abortion. In 2022, when the US Supreme Court overturned its landmark Roe versus Wade ruling that protected a woman's right to an abortion, Missouri became the first state to implement a near blanket ban on the procedure, the only exception being cases where the mother's life is in danger, while women have to travel to abortion clinics outside the state, as NewsHour's James Menendez reports.
It was heart-wrenching. It was a Tuesday morning. It was like 9:45. I was absolutely in shock from the trauma. My world crumbled that day.
That's Erica, who lives on the other side of the state in the confusingly named Kansas City. A year and a half ago, she was given the news that no mother-to-be wants to hear.
I had a very wanted pregnancy, second pregnancy with my husband, and we went into our routine 20-week anatomy scan, so halfway through my pregnancy, when my doctor came in and told me my son, who we named Easton, had a fetal anomaly, and she went on to share what it meant if he survived. And so for us, thinking about our living child, thinking about Easton and his quality of life, thinking about our marriage, we did make the choiceless choice to seek an abortion.
And compounding that horrible situation was the fact that Missouri has an almost total ban on abortions. You live in Kansas City, Missouri. And therefore, were there big questions about how you were going to get the treatment, the abortion you needed? What was presented to you?
So when I got to maternal fetal medicine and they ran the additional tests, she told me where I could go. And it was a 10-hour car ride to Denver, Colorado, or a airplane to Washington, D.C. to be able to receive the health care that I needed, which was an abortion.
Erica, can I just ask you this finally? I mean, there are those on the other side of the argument who feel very passionately and very deeply about this issue, deeply opposed to abortion. They believe the sanctity of the fetus's life is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
I would say our decision was made out of immense motherly love and fatherly love. I did not want my child to suffer. Yeah, that means that I will forever miss him and grieve him and wish that things were different. But as a parent, aren't you supposed to protect your child? Aren't you supposed to love them, even if it means that you don't get what you want?
As we heard there from Erica, she had to go to Washington, D.C. to get the abortion she needed. For other women in St. Louis, the journey is much shorter, just across the Mississippi River from the city into another state, Illinois, where abortion is still legal. It just takes about 30 minutes across the bridge, and it's a journey we're going to do today. Well, with us on this journey across the river into Illinois is Jen Jester, midwife. And Jen, the reason you've come with us is because you have accompanied at least a couple of women on their journey into the next state to get an abortion.
The women that I've served are usually low resource and don't have much support. And so the few that I've accompanied over the river have needed an escort there and an advocate to make sure that they're getting to the right place and also to make sure that they're emotionally and mentally protected when we arrive, because the security is tight, it's a gated facility, protesters can sometimes be hard to deal with, and so protecting their space and helping them get the care that they need, especially crossing state lines, can be a delicate matter.
Just turning into the clinic, there's a couple of people holding up placards, which it's difficult to know who the protesters are.
It is very hard to know. They look very official. They have their walkies and their vests on. They look very, very official.
And so they say they've got bibs
saying clinic escort, but they're not clinic escorts.
These are clinic escorts right here.
The ones that are holding
the signs saying "Don't pay attention." They are protesters.
Oh, the ones at the gate with the protesters.
Yes, the ones right outside the gate.
I thought they were the official ones.
Right, because they look very official.
They look more official than the ones who are actually.
And they have their walkie-talkies pinned to the vest, and they're so happy to see you.
Gosh, that is that's very confusing. Good morning. We're from the BBC in London. Can we just ask, can we talk to you briefly about what you're doing in your protest? Do you mind?
This isn't a protest. We're offering these people free services.
Well, can we just ask you about that? You don't have to give your name or anything. We just want to know what's going on.
Talk to this woman. Unless our supervisor...
Well, as you heard there, they don't want to talk to us. They kept on insisting that they weren't protesters. They were just giving information to people coming into the clinic. But they're standing outside the clinic and they definitely don't have anything to do with it. They did give us a card for a number to call to try and get permission so that they could speak to us. That number just rang out. Across the road, facing the clinic, we did find someone who was clearly a protester because we heard him shouting something over the fence earlier. He's now kneeling down right by the roadside. He's praying. I did gently go up to him and say, you know, would you mind speaking to us? He simply said, I just want to carry on praying.
Missouri became the first abortion-free state. Missourians have fought hard.
Opponents of Amendment 3, as the vote on restoring the right to an abortion in Missouri is known, are still battling in the courts and in the court of public opinion to get it struck off the ballot in November. That campaign has been led by Republican State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman.
I'm the architect of the Missouri law that is currently in place, so I think it's morally right. I think it is the position of many, many Missourians. But I'm also not blind, and I can see that there are people who do think that that is too extreme. But I believe that every life is sacred and that we should do everything we can to protect the unborn.
And where does that belief come from? Is it a religious belief?
Yeah, no, it's just basic science. I mean, the gametes meet, you are creating a unique individual human being, and they are due protection under the law, just as you and I are.
Is your position on abortion a vote loser for Republicans as we go into November?
No, I mean, listen, I think people are going to be looking at a broad range of issues and not just that one issue.
It's quite an important issue, though, isn't it? And all the polling suggests that a majority of Americans believe that there should be some access to abortion. And we've seen Donald Trump, for example, apparently flip-flopping on where he stands on this issue because he seems to be aware that actually this may cost him the election. Do you think that's true?
No, I think if you look at the history of what Donald Trump has done in this issue, it's been a little bit messy. Going back to the 2016 campaign, I think that like most Americans, it's not his top issue. He's not paying attention to it at the same level. And so he'll say things and then he'll learn more and he'll say, you know what, actually, I was wrong on that.
And that was NewsHour's own James Menendez there reporting from Missouri on the issues many people, especially women, looking at ahead of the US election coming up. Don't forget, of course, the US televised debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump is later on today. You can follow all the details on the BBC website. Lots of analysis there. Our teams in the country looking at some of the preparation that both sides have been doing going into that debate. And of course, the details on the latest polls, which it looks as if are very close indeed across the country. So lots to look at there. And of course, we'll have a special edition of NewsHour tomorrow, picking over what happened in the debate the morning after the night before.
The most famous wrestler in Iranian history.
When Gholamreza Takhti entered, there was chaos.
Whose legend is surrounded by mystery.
Really? Takhti died? How come?
Immediately the rumors started.
Legend of Takhti.
Was Takhti actually trying to provoke the regime?
Part of amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Some business news now that will affect the big tech giants, well, in Europe at least. The European Union's highest court has just ruled that Apple must pay $14 billion in unpaid taxes to Ireland, and the court also dismissed an appeal by Google. Google had been trying to get a fine it faced for abusing its dominant position on online searches dismissed, but the decision was upheld. I think they owe $2.6 billion. Let's speak to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, about all of this. Danny, I mean, these rulings seem like a pretty big win for the EU Competition Commissioner today.
They're absolutely massive win, both for the Commission and for the woman who's led these long-running cases. So the Apple case, Rebecca, just to remind people, is about where Apple was allocating its profits. So the Commission said that it wasn't paying the fair amount on its European profits in Ireland, but it was using aggressive tax planning to shift these profits to the US. The court backed the Commission on this. It said that, in effect, Apple had been receiving a legal state aid from Ireland, which was incompatible with the single market. Now, Margrethe Vestager, the Competition Commissioner, has called this a win for tax justice and also for a level playing field in the single market. She says that the case, in essence, is about fairness. And at the time of bringing the case, she said that one of the Apple subsidiaries paid a tiny fraction of 1% of profits in taxes in 1 year. Apple, of course, one of the richest countries in the world.
So
she said it's about fairness. It's about fairness that all big and small companies pay their fair share of taxes. And it's fairness also about European member states, so that you don't have one member state undercutting other member states in terms of its tax regimes, and a social fairness, because obviously the money from these taxes go to pay things like health, education and other services.
What's the response been from Apple and Google today?
Yeah, well, Apple has said that it consistently pays one of the biggest amounts of tax in the world. It says this wasn't about tax, but where it pays it. And it said that it paid $20 billion in taxes in the US on the same profits that the Commission said should have been paid in Ireland. So both it and Google have expressed disappointment. Margrethe Vestager talked about the Google case, which is a different one. It's not about tax, it's an antitrust ruling. Mm. She said that this was a landmark judgment, one of the first significant antitrust cases against a tech giant, and so that companies are free to innovate, but they're not free to abuse their market dominance. No one is above the law. And that she said that's been a catalyst for change in terms of how these tech giants are treated as well.
Very briefly, is Ireland going to get to keep that cash?
Yeah, Ireland, interestingly, fought with Apple against the Commission on this case. It's always said its tax arrangements were fair and it doesn't have any special deals. But now it's going to release $14 billion that's been held in an escrow account, and it gets to spend those on services. So everyone's happy.
That's good. Danny Eberhard, thanks so much for coming in live to help us understand that story. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's head to India now, to West Bengal, because striking junior doctors in the state have defied a Supreme Court ruling ordering them back to work by 5 p.m. today. The strikes began about a month ago in response to the brutal rape and murder of a trainee doctor inside a government-run hospital. This was the R.G. Carr Medical College in Kolkata. Sound of some of the protests. Well, the junior doctors have been demanding better security at hospitals. Here's Amrita Bhattacharya, who's still striking in the West Bengal Junior Doctors Front.
The heinous crime which happened on 9th of August 2024 has shaken us all to the very core, and there's no need to speak about it again because we all know what has happened. It is the events that have happened after that are more disturbing for us. The way it was tried to cover up this crime, that is why we are in this protest all together. This is no longer just a doctor's protest. This is a protest of the entire community. While the criminals are roaming around free around us in our hospitals, we are not safe to join duty. So as long as that does not happen, we cannot rejoin duty.
Well, in another development, the former principal of the same hospital, Sandeep Ghosh, has been charged by the Central Bureau of Investigation, the CBI, and is being held in custody. That's been extended today as the investigation continues. It relates to financial irregularities. Let's see if we can get more details with Mandeepa Banerjee, who's senior freelance journalist based in Kolkata. Mandeepa, thanks for coming on the programme. Briefly, first, on the striking doctors, what are the reasons they're giving for defying this Supreme Court ruling?
Well, none of their demands have been met. That is what the junior doctors are claiming. Their primary demand is, of course, justice for the girl, the trainee doctor who was raped and murdered. They want the culprits identified and, brought to court and punished for their crime. But they are not happy with the way the investigation into the case has carried on. And they feel the investigation is full of loopholes and the clear picture is just not emerging, even one whole month after the horrific incident took place at RG Kaur Hospital. And that particular incident also, sort of made them pause and think about the kind of insecurity and lack of safety they have at the workplace. They want that improved. That has not happened either yet, they say.
And Monideepa, there's a lot of rumours, unsubstantiated rumours, discussion going on in the state at the moment around what's been happening at this hospital. And then we've got this case of the former principal at the same hospital under being arrested by the police. What can you tell us about that?
Well, initially, the police filed a case against the principal of this college for corruption. All kinds of corruption charges surfaced. The police filed a case. The government, set up a special investigation team. But soon after that, the, Central Bureau of Investigation, which is a central agency, they took over the case on orders of the court. So the case is now in the hands of the CBI. And the CBI has arrested Sandeep Ghosh, the principal, on the 2nd of September on charges of diversion of funds and receiving kickbacks. The remand order that the CBI has shared with the media says that Ghosh was part of a nexus along with other accused persons. By way of illegal means, he caused wrongful losses to the government and wrongful gains to himself and his friends. He favored firms of belonging to his friends and associates to give away tenders, which involved a lot of money. Okay. For work at the hospital.
So those are the accusations against him.
That's right.
At the moment, because he hasn't been to court yet. He's just been charged. But briefly, Monideepa, where does all this leave the patients? They must have issues with staffing if so many junior doctors are not working there.
The junior doctors issued a statement yesterday with some very interesting numbers. There are 93,000 registered doctors in the state of West Bengal. Out of that 93,000, 7,500 are the junior doctors, doctors who are doing their master's degree, who are the ones on strike. Okay. Doctors say that other doctors are working, the hospitals are running, and the disruption for patients is minimal.
Okay,
the government, however, says one death too many. One death is a death too many.
Monideepa,
so the government wants them back at work.
We must leave it there. Thanks so much, Monideepa Banerjee there in Kolkata. Now, it was an incredible journey for the shy young boy from Mississippi with a debilitating stammer who became known for having the most famous voice in Hollywood. Actor James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. But during his distinguished career, he played many roles from comedy to Shakespeare. But there's one role that will always be associated with him.
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him. No. I am your father.
Darth Vader, of course, the dark Sith Lord from the Star Wars franchise. As many will know, James Earl Jones only ever played the voice of Vader, never the physical role, but with that velvety, authoritative, low tone, a legend was made. He talked about his early struggles with his voice, which badly affected his childhood years.
I was a mute until I was about 14 because I'm a stutterer. I still am a stutterer. And when I learned how to work around that stutter, I learned the great beauty in those who could speak. I wanted to speak some too, not just the sound of my voice, but the sound of words and the meaning of words.
Well, to reflect on his amazing life and career, I've been speaking to British actor Anthony Daniels, also known as C-3PO, the golden humanoid robot that was on the side of the goodies in Star Wars, The Rebel Alliance.
You know, he was such an integral part of the whole thing. Not exactly from the beginning, because, of course, he wasn't there on the set. Well, it was only when I saw the finished film, well, a year later, that suddenly that strange thing on the set had been transformed into really something quite wicked.
I want to ask you about that, because, as you say, he wasn't on the set filming that first Star Wars movie, was he? But when you heard the great booming bass voice coming out of Darth Vader, I mean, he was terrifying, wasn't he? How did you feel when you first heard that voice?
You know, I was there on set with the suit, the person in the suit, and actually it was hilarious because the voice was utterly different and utterly not a villain's voice. And the other thing that many people in the audience won't realise, but you can actually pick it up if you look at the movie again, the person in the suit, Dave Prowse, had a completely different approach to the lines, which he rattled off like Billy-O, mostly with finger pointing. And if you look, what they did wrong, and they did many things wrong over the years in these movies, but one of the silly things is they subsequently altered it, they didn't give enough airtime or screen time to allow James's rounded voice and gorgeous intonation and so on. Mm-hmm. There was no space on the film. There was only that much footage. So he had to cram a lot of the lines in. So it was partly a visual thing and partly an audio thing as well.
And what was it about his voice that was so extraordinary? Because, I mean, it's not just the natural speaking tone, which he was very lucky to have that bass tone, wasn't he? But it was the way that he used it as a performer, surely.
You know, from an early age, he had a very bad stutter and really, really worked to overcome it. And one of the ways was to go down into the lower reaches of his chest and all that kind of thing, where these resonators are.
Oh, wow.
And He used that as a tool, and then it became the most wonderful acting thing that he had. But also with Vader, he slightly altered his intonation. And in fact, he said, well, back, come episode whatever, 2, 5, he completely forgotten what he'd done. So he had to be reminded of how to be Vader again. And of course, from then on, he was Vader forever, and he will be Vader forever. Because with the number of fans around the world of all ages, you know, that voice is going to haunt the galaxy for eternity. And what is gorgeous for me, not to turn the conversation to myself, but in November, I will be yet again hosting Star Wars in Concert in Los Angeles. And for 4 nights, James's voice will ring out, introducing me as part of the rebel scum. And I will go on stage with his voice ringing in my ears, and I will smile.
Oh, it is fabulous. And as you say, you were there right from the start with Star Wars. And your own character, C-3PO, has a very distinctive voice when you're in character.
When I'm in character. He's a little bassy this morning because late nights and so on. But if I think about it, C-3PO, I was built by Anakin Skywalker, and Anakin became Darth Vader, my.
And on all your tours and reunions that you all had together, what was he like then? How did he feel about being the voice of Darth Vader?
It all came as a huge surprise to him that this was, you know, it was a tiny job. Vader actually has very few lines in the movies. For him, it was a quick voiceover. from this silly space film that we all thought was crazy back in 1976 when we were making it. So I bet he was in the studio going, who are these people exactly? What's my problem? Why am I breathing like this? all these things. Because it was a crazy, you know, I'd been reading the script for 6 months, so I was quite attuned to what was going on. I still didn't understand it, frankly. And it was only with the editing and of course, John Williams' music. And there's a point I will make, whereas James Earl Jones had the best theme ever, 3PO doesn't get a theme at all. And I that makes him sad. But James Earl Jones, can you hum the theme for me?
Do 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 do. I don't know where it goes after that.
Do 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 do. Thank you, and may the force be with you.
Anthony Daniels there, or C-3PO, and he says he didn't get his own theme, so he was appealing for any musicians listening to write him one. Sorry about the singing, didn't mean to spring that on you. Anyway, his reflections there, Anthony Daniels, on the life of James Earl Jones, who has died at the age of 93 there. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, since the Taliban retook power in Afghanistan 3 years ago, the women of the country have had their human rights systematically reduced, freedom of movement, education and financial independence all severely curtailed. Then, just 2 weeks ago, the Taliban supreme leader passed a new morality law demanding that women's faces and bodies must be fully covered at all times, and even their voices must not be heard. Last week, you may remember, we heard from Afghan women bravely defying that ban by posting themselves singing online. Well, our South Asia correspondent Yogita Lamei has been in Afghanistan and managed to speak to women about life under the Taliban.
On previous visits, we've met with a psychologist who's talked to us about what she calls a pandemic of suicidal thoughts among Afghan women because of the restrictions on them. We've come back to meet her again. It's too risky for us to go to where she lives, so we're meeting in a separate, discreet location to find out what she's experienced since the new law was passed.
I'm experiencing one of the worst stress ever. My stomach has started so much issue. I've started having sleep issues. Even if they don't come to you and tell you that you have to cover your face, you don't have to like laugh or talk, but when they just go beside you, you just feel like shock. You feel like that your heartbeat gets up high. So it's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of hopelessness.
You're a psychologist. You've been communicating with lots of people who talk to you about their mental health problems. But especially since the new law was passed, what are people telling you about what their state of mind is like?
Actually, most often when I talk to friends, to my students, to colleagues, there is no hope. And it's better to die than to live in this situation. These are societal thoughts. It's getting a lot and a lot day by day.
Every time these incremental restrictions on women have been announced in Afghanistan, in the past, what we have seen is small groups of women marching on the streets, shouting slogans, asking for the right to study and the right to work. This time around, though, we have seen no demonstrations of those sort. We know the Taliban has clamped down on them. We've come to meet a woman who used to be a part of those protests. She has to move houses every few weeks for her safety. Because of the risks she's facing, it's taken quite a bit of time to figure out the logistics to try and even meet her safely. She asked for her voice to be changed so she wouldn't be identified.
I thought it was my duty to join the women who were protesting for our rights. The Taliban beat me and dragged me into a vehicle saying, "Why are you acting against us? This is an Islamic system. They took me to a dark, frightening place and insulted me with terrible words. We were treated like animals, and that's why we couldn't continue protesting. After being released from detention, we weren't the same people we were before.
She broke down as she spoke. Now, Afghan women have been showing their dissent by posting videos of themselves online, singing songs criticizing the Taliban's actions. I've come to the Taliban government's media center. I'm here to meet the Taliban government's deputy spokesman, Hamdullah Fitrat, and I'm going to ask him about the new law.
There are people in your own country, there are even people who are working for your government who say that your interpretation of the Sharia is wrong, that the Sharia does not deny women basic rights. How can you justify a law that doesn't allow their voices to be heard in public?
The laws that have been introduced have been approved by the Supreme Leader in accordance with Islamic Sharia. Any religious scholar can check their references.
Most of the girls and women we've spoken to in your country say they are prepared to wear whatever it is that your government prescribes as long as you allow them to study. And because they're not being allowed to do that, they're being driven to the point of depression, even suicidal thoughts. Isn't it your responsibility as a government to listen to those voices and act on it?
Absolutely. Our sisters' education is an important issue. We are trying to resolve this, which is the demand of a lot of our sisters. We have mentioned it several times in the past too, that our leadership is working on it. A solution will be found.
It's been 3 years now since girls were locked out of schools. Do you really expect people to believe that you are committed to actually doing it?
We are awaiting the decision of our leadership.
Inshallah. It's been evident for a long time that there are divisions within the Taliban on the issue of women's education. And while for most women and teenage girls that means that they're blocked from getting an education, from college, from work of any sort, during our visits to this country, we have often heard that there are pockets where there are government-run efforts to include women specifically in the public health sector. And now we've been given exclusive access to something that usually stays running behind the scenes. I'm at a training course for midwives that's run by the Taliban Public Health Department. And all of the women in front of me, there are about a dozen of them. All of them are young women who appear to be in their 20s. My family feels proud of the work that I do. It gives me positive energy. I'm happy to be able to serve the people of my country. 27-year-old Safiya told us. What I'm seeing in front of me, this is not likely to bring hope for a majority of women and teenage girls, but it is perhaps evidence that there are people within the Taliban government who are trying to facilitate and enable the exceptions to the stringent laws where it's possible.
And that was our South Asia correspondent Yogita Lemayi there reporting from Afghanistan. Now, we've just got time to check in on the big event happening later tonight. That's the US presidential debate coming up. NewsHour's own Tim Franks is stateside. I'm not quite sure where you are, Tim, but I know you'll be watching tonight.
I certainly am going to be watching, Rebecca. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. I know I'm normally guilty of giddy hyperbole, but it really is potentially the most consequential presidential election debate for generations. So tight. Kamala Harris, such a new entrant. And I'm in a state which was nail-bitingly close last time round, very controversial when Donald Trump tried to get the result overturned. Looks like it's going to be very tight this time, and we're going to have all sorts of reaction for you.
Fantastic. We look forward to that. Tim, thank you so much. Special programme tomorrow, this time tomorrow, with the BBC's Tim Franks there in Atlanta. From all of us here, thanks for listening.
the most famous wrestler in Iranian history.
When Gholamreza Takhti entered, there was chaos.
Whose legend is surrounded by mystery.
Really? Takhti died? How come?
Immediately the rumors started.
Legend of Takhti.
Was Takhti actually trying to provoke the regime?
Part of Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.